Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into Vietnam and the Vietnam Holding Investment Trust in what is an especially important year for this investment trust. It is the 20th anniversary coming up later on this year. We're going to be discussing how the trust has performed over the last year and the outlook for the year ahead. And to do that, we're very kindly joined once more by Craig Martin, who is the chairman of Dynam Capital, who is the manager of the Vietnam Holding Investment Trust. Craig, very much welcoming you back to the podcast today.
Jonathan, thank you for that and a very happy new year. Great to talk to you again.
Yes, happy new year. I hope we have a prosperous new year for all involved in Vietnam Holding. We're going to be discussing, Craig, today, the Vietnamese economy in some detail. We're going to be linking that through to the Vietnam Holding portfolio and how that's been changing. But before we get started, please could you give us an introduction, first of all, to yourself, as well as the investment trust, for those that may not be aware, please.
I'm Craig Martin, and I chair Dynam Capital. We have a team of investment professionals on the ground in Vietnam looking at interesting companies, listed companies predominantly in Vietnam. And Vietnam Holding is an award-winning fund. We're listed on the main board of the London Stock Exchange. And as you say, it's been focused on the exciting market of Vietnam for the past 20 years. And the aim is simple, to deliver good risk-adjusted returns from the growth coming from this country, from the modernization, the rapid development of the Vietnamese economy. It's a simple fund to understand. There's no funny stuff in there. It's easy to buy for investors. We think it's a great way to add diversification to a UK equity portfolio.
Just drilling down a little bit further, Craig, into Vietnamese stocks and the Vietnamese companies that you like to look at. Please, could you talk a little bit about how you position the portfolio, how concentrated you are, and some of the types of companies that you like to look for to include in the portfolio, please?
Yes, well, look, we are concentrated. We've typically got about 25 companies in the portfolio at any one time. We've probably got another 25 waiting in the wings that we've researched and we keep a very close eye on. And when their time comes and they're ripe, you know, we'll allocate to those and take some profit from one of our other names. We're really looking at the fundamental growth in a couple of key sectors in Vietnam, in the broadly the modernization of the economy that's leading to opportunities in consumer companies, the urbanization of the country that leads us longer term to looking at how cities are going to modernize and the opportunities in modern trade, and also potentially in real estate. Also the businesses that play into Vietnam's great position as a manufacturing center, the kind of logistics and services. And that's kind of all underpinned through financial services, banks, which form a large part of our portfolio. But in essence, we're a stock picker. We're looking for companies at a reasonable valuation with good growth prospects that can sustain their earnings, and we're looking to generate good returns for investors over the mid to long term.
Thank you. And we're going to be discussing some of those companies specifically a little bit later on in the podcast. But Craig, of course, one of the biggest drivers of the Vietnamese stock market is the economy, which has been driving forward towards the latter stages of 2025. Despite what people may think about what's happening with tariffs. And I don't think we can have a conversation about Vietnam at this point without touching on tariffs in some way, because of course that did cause volatility, not only for Vietnam, but many emerging markets last year. And it'd be really good to get your perspective on what's actually happening on the ground at the moment, Craig, because of course there was some back and forth on the tariffs. Vietnam was one of the first countries to have meaningful conversations with Donald Trump, and you know that came out with a resolution pretty quickly. But from where you're sitting and looking at what's happening on the ground in Vietnam, is there any visible impact on tariffs on the economy and maybe the equity market, and how is Vietnam adapting to the new tariffs?
Well, as you say, you can't really have a conversation or a sentence with the word Trump in it without tariff being somewhere in that sentence or at least in that paragraph. And Vietnam's been adapting well to this challenging global environment. And actually, last year in 2025, despite the kind of tariffs and the tariff noise globally and the tariffs against Vietnam, it grew its exports by around about 17% and actually generated a $20 billion trade surplus during the year. And within that, a third of its exports are still to the US, and that's growing. But very interestingly, Vietnam's very pragmatic. As you mentioned, they were quick to kind of negotiate, and they could see you've got a transactional president. So they got on the plane quickly and tried to negotiate the tariffs down, which they did. They went from about 46% down to 20% fairly quickly. But Vietnam has agreed to kind of increase its imports from the US. We've seen a significant increase last year and probably more to come. These are agricultural inputs that Vietnam doesn't have. Soybean, for example, for animal feed. Other forms of energy that Vietnam doesn't have. So like LNG, Vietnam doesn't have any of that. America's got heaps, bring that in. Vietnam doesn't manufacture aircraft. It's got a growing, rapidly modernizing airline industry. So let's buy some American Boeings. So we see that continuing. And that's good about kind of trying to balance the books, at least visibly, for a transactional president. I should say also about one third of Vietnam's exports are IT products. So it's not just raw materials. These are, you know, manufactured goods. These are leading smartphones and computers and accessories, digital tools that we use, everyone uses around the world. And these are actually already low or non-tariff. So the tariffs haven't really impacted that at all. So answer your question, I think in the second half of last year, the equity markets in Vietnam largely shrugged off the tariffs after that very initial queasy roller coaster of April and the reciprocal tariff. And so I think, you know, the Vietnamese domestic investors largely have looked beyond those tariff storms we saw in 2025.
Just looking here, that I believe that the Vietnamese equity indices hit record highs earlier on this year. So that rally has continued into 2026. But looking past the tariffs and the impact on the economy, Craig, what else is happening on the ground at the moment? Because I know Vietnam Holding, of course, has big themes that you like to invest in terms of digitalization, urbanization, industrialization. How are those other areas of the economy performing beyond exports?
Look, I think Vietnam's firing on all cylinders. The engine's hot and running. So despite the tariffs, the China plus one theme, this is where manufacturers look to move to Vietnam to manufacture goods to export, remains very, very strong and on track. As a result of that, foreign direct investment into Vietnam, building factories and the like, reached another record high, close to $27 billion last year. But I think the government are very pragmatic. They're also trying to be a little bit more domestically oriented. So last year, we saw a number of resolutions passed by the government to really continue the economic reforms that set on a journey, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But this time, encouraging the private sector to grow and the public sector to adapt and reinvent itself. And they also invested more than $30 billion of public money in domestic infrastructure. And we think that has a tremendous kind of leverage effect on the economy. So last year, we saw a focus on accelerated growth. 8% was the target in terms of GDP growth for 2025, achieved. You know, that's the highest growth pretty much in the world. And then they've actually got double-digit growth targets for 2026 and beyond. In addition to that, I should say again, on the domestic attraction of Vietnam, it's a great country for tourism, and it's seen a significantly strong rebound in tourism. Now got a lot of Chinese tourists and Indian tourists, and that's been good also for the local domestic economy, despite the fact that it means, you know, the airports have been busier, longer delays when you're going in and out. But so domestic importance as well as export remaining importance. It's got these two strong pillars. Now, for many emerging markets, take, for example, Argentina, you know, it's mainly an export story, and that makes you very much a captive to other markets, whereas Vietnam's both an export story and it's an important and growing domestic economy as well.
You mentioned there, Craig, that the new targets that Vietnam has for growth, but we're going to pick up on those a little bit later on in the podcast. But I do want to mention something that was particularly important and exciting for Vietnam that happened last year. Of course, that was the upgrade to emerging markets status. How has that impacted the equity markets so far, Craig? Did we see a big wave of inflows from foreign investors? Is it being more gradual? Is it picking up? How are you monitoring this at the moment?
Well, look, I think it was much waited for and expected, and Vietnam had been on the watch list for FTSE Russell for about 7 years for inclusion in the secondary emerging market. So we haven't seen a lot of additional major inflows yet. And after all, the actual inclusion won't take place until this September 2026. And that's subject to a fairly routine review in March. So actually, during the year 2025, we saw a large net outflow of foreign capital from the stock market. We saw a lot of foreign direct investment in, as I mentioned, into factories. But from the stock market, we saw what happened across other emerging markets, a lot of outflow back to developed markets, such as the US, chasing the Magnificent Seven and all those stocks. So we haven't really seen yet the big inflow. But what we have seen is a great deal of domestic interest, and we've seen a raft of new IPOs. Now, there haven't been many IPOs in Vietnam for several years, and now we've had several just in the last 6 or 7 weeks, and a couple more happening as we speak. There's also a lot of renewed interest in what it takes now to get an MSCI upgrade. This is a much perhaps more substantial index, and that's in a few years' time. So, you know, I think it's been a great marker to the fact the government is responsible, reactive, and wants the foreign capital markets to develop. And the government signaled even more, look, we want to really open up our economy to foreign capital to grow our ambitions to be a modern industrialized economy. And so, you know, I think there's a lot more to come in the next couple of years.
Talking about the outlook from here, of course, you mentioned that Vietnam recorded 8% growth in 2025. Vietnamese leadership have set very ambitious targets of 10% for the year ahead, which is astronomical given, you know, the growth rates that we're seeing elsewhere in the world. What do you feel needs to be done, changed, or built upon to achieve these growth rates?
Well, look, firstly, look back over the last 30 years. Vietnam has averaged around about 6.5 to 7% GDP growth per annum. There's no other country that's achieved that in that kind of level of sustainability. The reason the government is pushing for a higher level of growth is it wants to kind of accelerate and escape the gravity of the middle income trap, where countries become older before they become richer. So it's really trying to have a deep look at what's needed to deliver that. So it set this target of about 10% growth. And to get there, it's got to look at really balancing reforms of the economy, of the state-owned enterprises, accelerating this investment of public infrastructure, because that's going to give a leveraged effect to economic growth, relaxing rules a little bit to give the private sector room to grow and a little bit more bite. But at the same time, it's got to manage inflation and maintain overall stability in the face of clearly still very much volatile global situations. So look, it's not an easy task, but it's good to have ambition. So maybe they don't hit 10%, but if they hit the 8% as they got in 2025, that's still a rapid level of economic growth and, you know, the envy of the world, I would have thought.
Indeed, indeed. Preparing for this podcast, I saw an interesting article by The Economist who wrote that Vietnam's growth is fast but fragile. What would you say that they're underestimating?
Well, look, I love The Economist. I've been a reader all my life. And yes, look, I tend to agree, particularly as the article was referring to the rapid rise of a couple of conglomerates within the Vietnamese economy, particularly one, Vingroup, which is part of a narrow-bound rapid growth in the stock market. As you say, the stock market index was up perhaps 37%. For growth in general, actually the aim of the government is to accelerate, as I say, away from the pull of this middle-income trap and recognises the need to kind of balance things out a bit. So I think this year we'll see that stability may be preferred over the pace of reform for reform's sake, but still with a target of high levels of growth. So last year, credit growth was allowed to reach about 18 to 20% across the banking system. This year, it's probably going to be contained a little bit more tightly, maybe around about 15%. So there'll be some kind of guardrails to that growth. And as I mentioned, look, even if we can't hit the 10% growth target, then we'll still do very well if we're at similar levels of 8%. So, you know, it's not growth at any cost. Vietnam's also signaled it wants green growth, because one thing that is fragile is the global ecology, not only the economy. And Vietnam recognizes that too. So it wants to make sure and attract more kind of green financing as well, that growth is not without disregard to, you know, the Vietnamese society and the environment as a whole. So it's got its job cut out for it. But I think as the chart in that Economist article showed, it's a terrific level of growth. And that level of growth is possible from an economy that's already been growing so rapidly over many years. The economy now is north of, you know, $500 billion in terms of GDP. And the per capita GDP is north of $5,000. That's double where it was, you know, less than a decade ago. So growth is important. Fragile, you know, sometimes the Economist does play around with words for the sake of it. So maybe that's what it's doing.
Yes. And as you say, Craig, if you aim for 10% but achieve 9 or 8%, that's still fantastic growth for the economy. So I'd like to move on now to the equity markets specifically, and then we'll go and discuss the Vietnam holding portfolio in more detail. As we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, Vietnamese indices have been hitting record highs. I think it would be good for listeners if we could drill down, Craig, into the composition of Vietnam's equity indices, you know, how narrow, how concentrated it is, how concentrated have the gains been, what are some of the biggest names and sectors that have been driving gains over the past 6 months or so since the Liberation Day tariffs?
Well, that same article you mentioned, the Economist article, kind of alluded to this concentration of the index gain and a few popular local stocks that really contributed to much of that gain. You've got a large domestic retail investor base in Vietnam. You've got more than 12 million active domestic investors. And they took, you know, the positive news of the economic reforms of the government and the preeminence of the private sector in the view of the government. And so they searched and they found, you know, the stocks they thought were going to do really well from that. And one, Vincom and the Vincom Group, went up 700% last year as a result. So if you strip that out of the index, and it's more than 10% of the index, then the gain as a whole was still a very decent kind of 11, 12% last year. But it has been quite a narrow, concentrated index gain for 2025. So we're not the entire index. We're an active portfolio of 25 names. We're trying to just find really good, sustainable, good growth at reasonable valuations. So it's an exciting market for the remainder of that year. But, you know, we've got to stick to our knitting and really find those good companies that are going to compound their earnings over the next 5 to 10 years.
Thank you. We're going to discuss some of those companies now, Craig, because, you know, looking at your fact sheets, there have been some pretty big changes to the portfolio over the last year to 18 months. So it'd be good if you could run through some of those in terms of the rebalancing, you know, how your thinking changed throughout the year and where you see value within the Vietnamese equities and what are you holding in your portfolio now going into 2026?
Well, look, as I mentioned, we're a very active investor. We're also a very nimble investor. So we're not scared to take profit and to take that profit and allocate that into other names. So if people look at our, say, portfolio today and compare it with a year ago, as you say, a number of names are different. About 12 months or so ago, our number one position was FPT, a leading IT technology and technology education business. That was our number one position. That's still in the portfolio. It's probably our number 10 position at the moment, but we're adding to that. I can talk on that later. And our number one position is Mobile World Group, which is an omni-channel retail champion. So that's about 10% of the portfolio at the moment. So we've kind of tilted a little bit more to the domestic economy. So FPT also sells services internationally as well as its domestic business. Mobile World is largely Vietnam focused. It has also a very fast growing retail business in Indonesia, which is interesting as well, but it's largely a Vietnam retail consumer play. We've also reallocated to some of the names that have been in our portfolio a number of years ago where we've taken profit in the past, and we've brought them back into the top 10. We've shifted again into Hua Fat, which is one of Southeast Asia's largest steel manufacturers. Now, if you're looking at infrastructure developments and growth in both residential and industrial real estate, one thing you need is construction steel and steel in general. And Hua Fat's got a very sophisticated integrated business. It's a significant player in that space. We've got a number of banks in our portfolio, and banks around about 35% of the portfolio. Probably, you know, 6 years ago or so, we had less than 10% of banks in our portfolio. But over the years, we've found a few banks that we really like. Some of them are, you know, digital champions. You mentioned digitalization, which is one of our kind of themes. And our second largest position in the portfolio, NB Bank, is a digital champion as well as being a significant financial services player. So it's got something like 25 million online accounts in a country of 100 million people, and it's providing innovative financial services to its customers. So we like that as well. So we're more, I'd say, confident now in the resilience of some of the retail names, so Mobile World and some of our other retail champions, and allocating back to some of our well-known, well-researched names. Some of the banks still have very attractive economics and reasonable valuations. In terms of real estate, which we've been underweight for a number of years and started to allocate a little bit more to last year, we think it might still take a couple more quarters to see a real rebound in that sector. You know, perhaps driven by renewed confidence, savings, and perhaps more accommodating interest rates. Last year, as I mentioned, we had taken profit in our number one position, FPT, but we have been adding back to it recently. Its profit growth continues to compound, even if at, you know, slightly lower levels than before, 18 to 20% per annum, which is not too shabby. It's a very well-managed group, and it also has a very interesting subsidiary, FRT, which is also separately listed. And that's another retail name that we like and we've been adding to. That's got a fast-growing domestic pharmaceutical business called Longchow. And we've been a fan of that for some time. So our philosophy and our portfolio approach is the same. We've got our concentrated portfolio of 25 names. As I mentioned, we've also got 25 names that have either been in the portfolio, we've taken profit, or we've been researching them for a long time, and they're ready to come in when they're ripe too. So we want to be nimble. We're not going to be the index, but we're going to be nimble. We'll take profit when it's a good time to take profit. And, you know, we follow our conviction. We're really a conviction-led strategy. And as we get to know the companies better and they do what they say, then we'll add more allocation to them.
Really interesting point that you make there, Craig, about some of your largest holdings and how you've sold those down and waited maybe for the price to fall back. But you still, of course, like the company and what they're doing, but maybe don't like the price at a particular point in time. And then when that price becomes a little bit more attractive, you step back into the stock. I think that's something that listeners should know.
Yeah, so that's right, Jonathan. Yeah, we will, you know, try to set like what we think is a target price. And once it's surpassed the target price, we might take some profit. That's, you know, on the good case where it's doing everything well. On the other side, if we find a company that doesn't do what we think it's going to do and they don't take our calls and we're worried about transparency or change in the market that they're not reacting to, then we're not scared to exit a position entirely. We've done that, you know, over the last several years as well. But we give, you know, companies a second chance. We'll track them. If the markets change, if the management improves, then we're always prepared to look at adding good companies back. Again, if we can figure out reasonable valuations and good growth, well-managed businesses, easy to understand business models, kind of defensive characteristics, as well as good growth. I know that sounds kind of paradoxical, but they do exist. Then we'll bring those into the portfolio.
I just want to pick up on something we discussed earlier on in the podcast, and that was the number of IPOs. And taking into consideration, Craig, that you like to really get to know a company before you make an investment in them. How are you treating new IPOs? Are you investing in any of them? Are you waiting to see how they perform, getting to know the management, as you say? You know, are there any particularly interesting IPOs that you've seen, maybe you wish you got into, or actually you did get into?
I think IPOs can mean different things in different markets and different countries. So a number of the IPOs that we've been seeing recently in Vietnam, and as I mentioned, there's been a drought of them for a long time, and so it's only in the last year that it's been picking up, or where companies we know very well are listing a subsidiary as an IPO, or carving out part of the business and listing that as an IPO. So we know the parent company, we know the underlying business, and then we've just got to get comfortable with the valuation and the trading prospects and the liquidity prospects for that subsidiary that's being kind of IPO'd or floated. So again, we can leverage off our research. We haven't seen too many businesses that are brand new appear up that we haven't been tracking. Although we do purely focus currently at the moment on the public market, our portfolio does allow us to invest pre-IPO. And so we're always looking and understanding what's happening in the broader market as well. And so, you know, we're never surprised, you know, by the names when they're ready to come through to IPO, or at least we haven't for the last wave of IPOs. So we have participated in a couple, and a couple more coming this year, which we think may be interesting as well. So we'll keep a close eye on it. We do our research. We've got our disciplines, though. We won't overpay. And sometimes in the past, we've waited for a company to list, and then we've tracked it once it's listed for some time before we've put our toes in the water. So it really depends on the valuation, the prospects, the opportunity, and the timing as well, to a certain extent.
One thing I noticed about Vietnam Holding and the portfolio, which I find quite interesting, is I think if we go back a year or so, Vietnam Holding shares were trading at a premium to the NAV. That has naturally widened to around about 10% now, in line with many investment trusts over the last 6 months or so. But also looking at the Vietnamese universe, and particularly the Vietnam Holding portfolio, they're still relatively low on a price to earnings ratio. I think it's around sort of 9 or 10 times earnings at this point in time. So you've got two elements there. You've got the discount to NAV of the trust portfolio. You've got the discount there of Vietnamese stocks to some of their overseas peers. So there's that double whammy of valuation advantage there. But as a manager, Craig, when you're looking at the universe that you have at your fingertips in Vietnamese shares, and you're seeing this strong growth out there, how difficult is it to keep a concentrated portfolio when there may be so many different stocks that are trading at good valuations?
Well, it's always a challenge. So we stick to our approach of being nimble and looking for quality rather than quantity. So that's partly why we've got a concentrated portfolio, as I say, of around those 25 names. And as you mentioned, the portfolio is on about a 9.5 times price earnings for 2026. Which is not expensive, and yet looking at an 18 to 20% earnings per share growth. So if you make a ratio of that, the price earnings to growth ratio, it's about 0.5, which is cheap. You know, analysts would look at a 1x ratio as being fair. And so at 0.5, there's good upside in that. But again, you know, not every stock is the same. So we're looking at many dimensions to each company. We've got a strict ESG criteria as well. We judge companies on about 80 different factors and we track them over time. But in essence, we are looking for that good growth at a reasonable valuation. And you know, we'll do our diligence and look into new companies and track them as well as those that are in the portfolio and compare. But as you say, you know, the Vietnam market is still undemanding in terms of valuation. It's still perhaps it's cheaper than many of its peers. And then when you come to the fund Vietnam Holding, as well as you alluded to, early part of last year, we were trading at a premium. We issued some more shares. Trump's tariffs kind of knocked the wind out of most stock markets around the world. And we went to a small discount and we're probably a single digit, maybe 6-7% discount to NAV at the moment. So it's still a very good opportunity to invest into Vietnam Holding and then get that relatively undemanding valuation and yet good growth of those Vietnamese companies that are in our portfolio. And I suppose the other thing to remember for investors into Vietnam Holding is a well-managed portfolio, but also once a year, investors have the opportunity to redeem some of their shares at net asset value if they choose to do so. So, you know, you've got exit opportunities as well as getting diversification and access to what we think is a tremendous growth story in Asia.
Indeed. I mean, very much a two-pillar valuation case there when we're looking at Vietnam Holding in the slight discount to NAV. And of course, that the good valuation of Vietnamese stocks, despite the high rates of growth that we're seeing out there. So Craig, really comprehensive conversation today. Thank you very much. I always like to ask this at the end of the podcast to really set the scene for the year ahead. As a manager in Vietnamese equities, what excites you the most about 2026?
Well, look, we're seeing as we come into this year, stock market sentiment is improving. Liquidity is continuing to increase. That's good. The ruling Communist Party this week is holding its 14th annual Congress, where it determines the key roles in the government. And I don't expect we'll see abrupt policy swings when it reports, perhaps at the weekend. More a continuation of the same, a push for this modernization, the industrialization, and lifting, you know, the economic situation of its 100 million people. And this year, you know, in the Lunar New Year, which starts mid-February, they call it Tet in Vietnam. This year, it's going to be the year of the horse. Well, if you compare, say, Vietnam as a horse, it's probably going to start off this year at a slow canter and will then get to a gallop maybe by the second half of this year. And no doubt we'll win the Grand National again if this was an emerging market horse race. So I think picking Vietnam could be a very good bet to push the analogy for UK investors, particularly if you want to find growth at that reasonable valuation. The macro story remains enviable. We're in the fastest growing part of the world. And clearly there are benefits of diversification, you know, perhaps away from the UK, perhaps away from Europe and the US. We trade at that narrow discount to NAV. So that implies trust in what we're doing. And again, later this year, there'll be an annual redemption opportunity. So look, if people haven't looked at Vietnam, I would encourage them to do their research on Vietnam Holding and visit our website, www.vietnamholding.com for more information. But I think it's going to be an exciting year ahead.
Thank you very much, Craig. And as a note to listeners, if you would like to find out more about Vietnam Holding, you can indeed visit their website, as Craig suggested. But or you can also visit the UK Investor Magazine Investment Trust Centre. There'll be a link in the notes of this podcast through to Vietnam Holding's page. You'll be able to see a library of different media that Vietnam Holding have done over the last year, some podcasts, some presentations, as well as some of their literature. So do check out the notes of this podcast and you'll be able to get yourself into that Investment Trust Centre there for more information. So Craig, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure again, Jonathan, as always. Thank you so much.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember all investment involves risk.